8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. Prosecutors have apparently secured the cooperation of at least one.
Today on the morning show, we are taking a look back at the Second World War, but doing so in very intriguing fashion with a most intriguing book called The Hidden Places of World War II, the extraordinary sites where history was made during the war that saved civilization. The Second World War has been a topic of fierce interest to my morning show guest, Jerome O'Connor, a native of Chicago, and someone who still makes his home in Elmhurst, and someone whose rich and varied life has included work as a journalist and historian and tour guide and lecturer. And he has done a great deal of writing on the Second World War. And I'm going to be speaking with him today about this newest book, which is published by Roman and Littlefield, in which he not only takes us through many of the most important events of the Second World War and helps us understand how that conflict unfolded, but also, in a sense, takes us to some of the places where very crucial decisions were made, where very important breakthroughs were made. And in many cases, we're talking about places that are not particularly well known to the public. And it is, as I said at the outset, a very intriguing way to look at a much-discussed conflict, which we are still, of course, coming to terms with all these years later. The book is actually published by Lions Press, which is an imprint of Roman and Littlefield, again titled The Hidden Places of World War II. And Jerome M. O'Connor, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm very pleased to be with you from down the road.
I appreciate it. It's interesting, in the short biography of you that is with the book, you make mention of being the only son of immigrant parents who left Ireland for the multi-ethnic porridge of Chicago's Englewood neighborhood. Can you just say a quick word about exactly where you grew up and maybe a word about how that has shaped this very interesting and varied professional life that you have enjoyed?
I indeed grew up on a multi-ethnic block, most of the block, immigrants from Ireland, from Scandinavia, from Poland, from Germany. I'm the son of immigrants. My father made it to third grade. My mother made it all the way to fifth grade, and never let him forget about that either. But perhaps the seeds of what would become the hidden places of World War II, all those decades later, began on that block, because I remember during the war that there was a certain hollowness in the neighborhood because the boys between 18 and 24 were gone from the neighborhood. They went off to war. And the proof of that was behind the windows with the lace curtains and the blue banners showing that the boys, husbands, brothers, sons, had gone to war. But on my block, about five doors down the street, there was a single bungalow that had a gold star. And that gold star meant that a son or a brother or a husband would never return. So on the way to the candy store at the corner with my 2 or 3 cents, I crossed the street so I wouldn't have to pass in front of the grieving, possibly widow or mother. So I had a certain reverence or fear. I don't know what it was. I know that perhaps the germination of what became the hidden places of World War II could very well have started on that Englewood Street. Mm.
You write in the preface to the book, "I had so much sorrow, or perhaps it was fear, for what lay behind the lace curtain of the window with the gold star, that on the way to the corner candy store, I crossed the street to avoid disturbing the grieving family inside. The other kids who played sewer cover stickball or jumped rope were also silent near that bungalow. The thought of it never left me. Maybe the desire to someday tell the stories started then." In fact, you start the preface by saying, "I have been writing this book since I was 5 years old," and I guess that's what you're getting at.
That's correct, but it was not just my block. There were similar instances on every block in Chicago, every big city, every small town in Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, everywhere. There were similar instances where the young men and young women who were noncombatants went to war. And this permeated through factories, through schools, where these young men left their farms or their factories, and they engaged in a cause that was greater than their own, not knowing if they would return to their parents or to their loved ones. And now, on the eve of the observance, not celebration, but the observance of the 75th anniversary of the end of the war, which comes in a few months in 2020, I wanted to honor their service and their sacrifice while there were enough of them with us to be honored for perhaps the last time. And I did it by locating, entering, discovering places of great importance in the war, mostly in Europe, that were overlooked, underreported, or in some cases just plain ignored by other journalists and historians. And that is what I set forth in the 350 hardbound pages with many, many photographs, most of them my own, in the book.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jerome O'Connor, and we're talking about his book, The Hidden Places of World War II. Just ahead of us digging into the book with some thoroughness, I want to ask you about two items that are in your biography that I think are really intriguing and that also can probably help kind of illuminate who you are and what you are about. One of the things mentioned in passing is that you are one of the original quiz kids on NBC radio and television. Explain to our listeners what that means.
Quiz Kids was the most popular quiz show of the era and the precursor of many others that emulated it. It was broadcast from the NBC studios in the Merchandise Mart. NBC had 50,000 watts clear channel so they could go up to the Rocky Mountains with their signal. And I was delivering the Chicago Herald American. We had four major English language newspapers in Chicago at the time, in addition to daily papers that were in Polish, in German, even in Hebrew. It was called the Jewish Daily Forward, written backwards. So I took the contest offered by the Quiz Kids, a means of boosting circulation, to appear on one of the shows, or maybe more of the shows. Much to my surprise, I passed the contest and did indeed appear with Quizmaster Joe Kelly, who before that had been on the National Barn Dance from the 8th Street Theater in Chicago for many years. So, yes, I did. I also appeared on the first TV show. Very much of a surprise, I must say.
Very good. I also want you to say a quick word about one facet of your career as a lecturer. And this is that you have made 4 transatlantic crossings as a history lecturer on the Queen Mary II. Just describe to our listeners what such a cruise is like and the kind of things that you would typically talk about during such a journey.
Well, that was also another surprise. I simply wrote to them at their headquarters in Southampton, identified myself, what I had done, because I am a journalist at heart, and I've been writing for some 52 years about those hidden places of World War II. And I had the opportunity to do enrichment lectures on the Queen Mary II, 102,000 tons, on crossings from New York to Southampton. And I did repeated crossings and talked to an average of about 350 people at each of 15 lectures. And I talked to them about World War II and about some of the chapters that ended up some years later in the book. And it was quite an experience to be there, talk to them, and then go to one of the embarkation ports, which happens to be the home port of Cunard Lines.
Very good. So tell us about the initial idea to explore the Second World War in this somewhat unconventional fashion. I think it's interesting. It's tricky to characterize this book or describe it because in many respects, this book is a straightforward exploration of much of what occurred with the Second World War and kind of those crucial turning points and what ultimately led to Allied victory. But you have done that in a way that is, I think, a bit out of the ordinary by giving focus to certain locations and particularly certain locations that you have had the opportunity to visit yourself. When did it occur to you that it would make sense to write a book about World War II and to write it in this way?
Greg, I have had a nearly compulsive need to explore places associated with the war for decades. And as an example, I was the first journalist to find and write about for the Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine the location in London where Winston Churchill had his war headquarters, a few hundred feet from number 10, exposed to German paratroopers or to bombs dropping from above. And it was in the basement of an old office building. What I attempt to do as a journalist and as an author is to go back to origins. So many other writers and authors pick up where somebody else left off. I'll give you an example as to going to origins. One of the chapters refers to the invasion of the European continent, and it's about a mansion called Southwick House. We might call it Southwick, but it's pronounced Southwick House, and it's in Portsmouth. It's the location where General Eisenhower made what I refer to in the book as the decision of the century. Now, other historians will talk about the D-Day invasion and go on from there, but I prefer to go back to the source. And the source, or the location for the decision, was in this appropriated mansion, an enormous mansion. And I located it, was able to enter it, and found that the vast former drawing room of the mansion, privately owned mansion, contained an enormous floor-to-ceiling plywood map, different sections affixed, showing all of the invasion beaches and the embarkation ports. And that is where Ike, with his commanders, had to decide, when do we launch the invasion? Because the invasion had been delayed by weather. And Ike, a humble man, but a very decisive commander, he had his headquarters in a very small trailer about a mile away from the mansion. The others luxuriated somewhat in the large rooms of the mansion, but Ike wanted to be with his troops. So on the drive in his vehicle, he passed through lashing rain and wind, entered the mansion, and knew that he had to make a decision. They were at sea. There were 156,000 Americans ready to enter the war at the five beaches. And in that room with the plywood map, he finally made the decision that we had to go. And that's just one example of one of the many places I visited that connected me from then to now. And I feel very strongly that history lives best when you can associate it with the real places that exist from then to now. In my case, it would be World War II.
Right. And I guess part of the point of your book is that many of these places exist, and many of these places exist and perhaps are even to some extent visited by people. I mean, they are open to being visited, and yet these are not, in a sense, the looming monuments that everybody might know about and talk about and immediately recognize. These are, in a sense, quieter places in many respects. And in some places, and in some respects, as your title suggests, are somewhat hidden, if not entirely.
One of them, very, very important place indeed, the U-boat bases along the Biscay coast in France. Now, the Bay of Biscay is an inlet from the Atlantic Ocean. As a little backstory to this particular locale, Hitler knew that if he could win the war, and he expected to win the war, he had to do it by severing the essential convoy lifeline connecting North America to mostly Liverpool. 80% of all the materiel needed to sustain Britain fighting alone came from North America, mostly from the United States, but also from Canada. So he invested a great deal of money in building five impenetrable U-boat bases along the Biscay coastline in France. And these bases survive to this day, looking from a distance as if they're brand new. And of course, getting close, you can see that there has been some damage. But these bases are essentially unknown, but they can be visited. They're not monuments. There's no admission charge. Somebody would have to do a bit of research to locate them, but they're in easily available ports such as Lorient, Brest, Saint-Nazaire, La Rochelle, and I explored them. And I did so mostly because I wanted to describe for readers the five-layer roof defense system, 23 feet, a layer upon layer of different kinds of defenses. Seen from above, inverted U-beams, concrete U-beams, Below that, a huge explosion chamber. Below that, other layers so that penetrating munitions would explode before reaching the dry docks where U-boats were undergoing 31-day overhauls. So the U-boat bases that are vast, now, you know Chicago and you know the former Sears Tower, which is now the Willis Tower. It is 1,450 feet tall, 110 floors. For years, it was the tallest building in the world. Well, just one of those bases is longer than the former Sears Tower is tall. And that tells me something about what Hitler knew about what he had to do to win the war and how the German engineers, in a diabolical way, were able to construct such works of man that would be the only part of that awful regime that would last for the advertised 10,000 years of the Third Reich.
Right. You cite some really kind of staggering numbers in terms of the raw materials it took to construct this kind of bunker. I mean, we're talking about, in some cases, millions and millions of tons of concrete and 1 million tons of steel just to construct one of these bunkers that house the U-boats. I mean, that right there tells us something about the scale that we are talking about.
Hitler had to hold back America. He knew that America would enter the war. So he had to defeat Britain and to defeat them as quickly as possible. To do so, he had to drive the RAF from the skies, which was not successful. But en route to what he expected to be the conquest of Europe, he had to overcome any final resistance from England by an invasion. And at the same time, complete the task of achieving victory over all of Europe by ending the supplies, or most of the supplies, coming in convoys from North America. But at the same time that he was doing this, the British, who knew that it was a war of survival, they were at another place described in the book called Bletchley Park. And Bletchley Park, which is easily reached from London, it's about an hour and a half by train, is where 12,000 British codebreakers, most of them women, were engaged in the most important secret of the war, except for the atomic bomb. And that was entering the labyrinth of this electromechanical cipher device called Enigma. And this machine was used to communicate with all of the armed forces of the German regime. And by all of them, I mean down to the company level. Every U-boat had an Enigma. Every element of the Wehrmacht had an Enigma, and the British knew that they had to solve the input. What went into the device was Morse code, but what came out of it was gibberish. So they had to unravel that secret, and your listeners will know that Alan Turing was one of those who engaged in deciphering the cipher or the code. But there were 12,000 others, kind of unsung heroes, along with a lot of others that I talk about in the book.
You tell us that actually there were 8 women for every man working in that facility at Bletchley Park doing this important work of code breaking.
It was thought that women had skills that men didn't have. Now, whether or not that is true is not a point I'm going to argue, but the fact is that the hierarchy felt that they had the patience, they had the mentality, they had the intellectual skills that were important such as patience in analyzing these messages and then entering them into crude code-breaking machines called bombs, B-O-M-B-E-S, for some reason I cannot understand. And these were electromechanical machines that broke down the messages. As I said, they were sent in Morse code, but that was the front end. The back end went through numerous permutations in the billions to be totally indecipherable. So the code-breaking machines would give the, as I said, mostly women code-breakers, clues. They called them cribs. Little clues that would enable them to use keywords. The keywords would help them to then build into perhaps a decipherable sentence. Here's what I mean by a keyword. U-boat commanders were required to give regular reports. They would surface at night when the chances of not being seen were at their best, when they could transmit farther, and they would give reports that were very brief because they knew that their messages were being intercepted. There were thousands of listeners along the British coastline at what were called Y stations, radio listening stations, Y is in yellow. And they would give a brief transmission. For example, need torpedoes, low on fuel, need to return. Just brief messages, but they would repeat these messages. And so they would pick up these cribs, and from those cribs develop menus. And from menus, eventually they had entire messages. And one of the greatest secrets that was so secret that it remained secret until 1972. So I had learned about the existence of Bletchley Park, and I visited it, not difficult at all, when it was completely unknown to the public. I merely crossed the street from the Bletchley Park train station and across the street, rusty barbed wire with signs saying government property, unauthorized entry prohibited. Well, I found a way to enter, and I saw scores of peeling wooden buildings. And this is where these code breakers spent their time working 10, 12, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week in revealing the secret of the century, the breaking of the Enigma code. And that's another one of many such instances that I think even the most astute professional or war buff would scratch his or her head and say, gosh, I just didn't know that.
Right. Explain to our listeners something about the experience you had of actually meeting one of these so-called secret ladies. I believe her name was Betty Warrick, who was part of this crucially important effort.
In the hidden places of World War II, I indeed describe a meeting I had then with my agent. I was then an executive in the travel business, a company that was called Cartan Travel, very well known at the time. And I was in charge of organizing meetings for groups in professional organizations, doctors, dentists, lawyers, for example. And in order to bring about the meetings abroad, I would meet with my agents who would meet the groups, organize the events. So my agent asked me to come out to dinner, and he brought his wife, Betty Warrick. And he knew of my interest because I had been already writing articles in magazines and newspapers about the war. He said, Jerry, how about Betty telling you a story about what she did during the war? And Betty told me that she was what they called a secret lady, and she worked at Bletchley Park. And her father was also engaged in espionage. He was in New York, working for the OSS as a liaison officer, and the OAS became the CIA. He didn't know what she was doing. She didn't know what he was doing. They were prohibited from talking about anything that they did to anybody up until 1972 under what was called the Official Secrets Act. Violation meant death, but death didn't worry them because they had something more important in mind, and that was patriotism. They had to survive, and for the British, it was a war of survival. So I met her, and I also learned at the same dinner about the existence of the Churchill Cabinet War Room. So I had two discoveries at one dinner. I'm not sure if I ate very much because I was taking notes throughout the meal. So not only did I get to visit Bletchley Park, echoing with emptiness, by the way, but I also was able to visit the following morning Churchill's cabinet war rooms, totally intact, central London. And if interested, I could tell you more about that as well.
Absolutely. Let me first introduce you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jerome M. O'Connor, who is the author of a very intriguing book called The Hidden Places of World War II, The Extraordinary Sites Where History Was Made During the War That Saved Civilization. The book is really a very careful chronicle of what unfolded during the Second World War and various ways in which the Allied effort was waged. In some respects, it's sort of like the war front versus the home front and the various facets of the war front, various facets of the war effort that ultimately led to Allied victory. And in many cases, we're talking about stories that have not been told as thoroughly or openly as they deserve. So yes, indeed, you actually very early in the book talk about the cabinet war rooms that were places where Churchill and his closest advisors met more than 100 times during the Second World War. Let's talk first of all about the surprising location of where the cabinet war rooms were actually located. This is something of a surprise.
Very much something of a surprise, because the government, the armed forces, wanted Churchill and his ministry, his cabinet, a coalition cabinet, to have an underground headquarters outside of London where they wouldn't be disturbed by bombings, of which there were hundreds and hundreds against London alone. Well, Churchill was a man with a determination, and one of them is that he didn't want to go far from home, which was number 10 Downing Street, and the headquarters where actually 154 wartime meetings were held. It's maybe a two-minute walk on a straight line from number 10. I know this because I did the walk. So in the basement of an already old building across the street from St. James Park, which is one of the four or five central London parks that connect eventually to Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens, in the cellar of that already old building, that is where his headquarters was situated. So that was the result of the second piece of extraordinary information from that dinner. So, Greg, I visited the rooms with an employee of my agent who, interesting, was a former RAF pilot. So we had things in common. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran myself. And we entered the enclave, a warren of tiny rooms and a couple of large ones, low overhead because it was the cellar of an office building, part of the tour with a one-cell flashlight, with the single curator of the enclave that looked to me as if its occupants had left at the end of the war on VJ Day, just walked out, turned off the lights, went to the corner pub, had a drink or maybe more than one drink, and never returned. One of the rooms had files. There were files throughout that were just scattered about. And I was able to enter each of the rooms, and my right elbow knocked off a yellowing file. I leaned down, picked up the file, and there across the top, in pen and ink, it said, Operation Overlord, Top Secret. I thought, what Hitler would have given to get that file, and no doubt many, many hundreds of other files, Hitler having his headquarters also in the center of Berlin.
Hmm. And you certainly raised the intriguing point that the fact that Churchill insisted on locating his war center in what was essentially an undefended office building meant that he was incredibly vulnerable. And if a German bomb had landed on that building, almost certainly that war center would have been consumed, destroyed. And who knows what would have happened to the Allied war effort if Churchill himself or important advisors had also been killed in such an attack. What an interesting mystery as to what was behind Churchill's decision to take a risk like that.
Oh, I think I can add something to that. He describes this in the first volume that he wrote about the history of the Second World War. He felt he was impermeable. He was on a mission. He was on a mission from God. He knew that he was destined for this hour of need, and that his whole life revolved around the single mission of saving Great Britain. And so he therefore felt nothing was going to stop him. Bombs weren't going to stop him because he wouldn't be killed. He just felt that he had this one chance in a lifetime dedicated to a single mission, saving Britain, saving democracy. But I have to add this, Greg. He never could have achieved it without Franklin D. Roosevelt. Also described in the book at some length are the secret missions that FDR, his great friend and equally important war leader, the missions by the U.S. Navy pre-war that took an entire division of British troops originating in Britain and boarded them on U.S. Navy ships that had been converted from passenger liners, including the SS America, on which I sailed years later. And these transports conveyed 20,800 British troops to what was thought to be the Far East and engagement against Rommel. It turned out that Singapore was in the process of being enveloped by Japanese troops who had invaded from the land side, not from the sea side, which was defended. So Churchill asked FDR to reroute the seven ships, American ships, pre-war, to eventually Singapore, and for many of them, three out of five, their death through torture and starvation. So I would associate FDR, who had his own challenges, be happy to talk about them as well, but FDR had his challenges knowing that he had to keep Great Britain afloat as an unsinkable aircraft carrier until the time came when he could bring the American people to the point of view from isolationism to accepting the fact that we were all in this together. But in order to do that, as a leader, he knew that he had to get his people, 132 million Americans then, to the point of view where they could say, we're all in this together. And he did that, among other ways, with a series of fireside chats. So I say the world, the free world, and the world that came out of the war, fortunate to have these great men at the same time.
And the connection between them. By the way, I appreciate a couple of pages early in the book when you describe the installation of what amounted to the first hotline between Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. And that was a technology that actually had not been around actually all that long to be able to establish that kind of very direct link between those two men. And that had to be a hotline that was utilized many times and for very important purposes.
I'm kind of smiling in the background here because the hotline, which did indeed exist as a cable under the Atlantic, was thought to be a toilet, a small room, and it even had the panel that said "Do not disturb" on it. But this was the room where the talks would take place between FDR and Churchill. And it was the first hotline. But in order for it to even function, about a mile away in the basement of Selfridge's department store on Oxford Street, an enormous enclave of transmitters and relays and tubes that enabled this hotline to function. But it was thought to be the world's first hotline that the occupants of the war rooms thought to be a toilet reserved for Churchill.
Wow.
Oh, by the way, this is interesting as well. Churchill tended to call FDR whenever he felt like it, essentially. And with a six-hour time difference, although that changed because they enacted wartime and then double wartime, but let's say 6 hours, FDR could be sleeping. So they painted a red indicator on the clock in the hotline room that indicated Washington time versus London time.
Interesting. You also tell us about the existence of a special map that was hidden essentially from anyone's view except Churchill, hidden behind a very thick drape, a drape you say was always closed and forbidden to all eyes except his, this special floor-to-ceiling color-coded map. Explain what this map was, why it was so crucial, and also why it was important that it not be seen by, in a sense, the wrong eyes.
Yes, in that chapter in my book, The Hidden Places of World War II, I describe in Churchill's bedroom a wall with a drape that was always closed except when updates had to be made. And that drape contained the possible invasion beaches. Invasion was deemed to be certain.
And you mean invasion of Britain? You mean invasion of Britain?
The invasion of Britain was deemed to be a near certain event. In fact, Ambassador to the Court of St. James, Joseph P. Kennedy, the father of the famous family and president-to-be John F. Kennedy, who served in the war as well, he was a defeatist. He told FDR, they're finished. They're not going to make it. Well, Churchill prepared for the worst, and that drape that was always closed, except to a few people when it had to be updated, contained the invasion beaches that were updated periodically. So even Churchill feared the worst. He feared that invasion was indeed possible.
Finally, I want us to take just a moment to talk about a chapter that you devote to the USS West Point, a very special ship, and its very special role that it played through the course of the Second World War. Describe to our listeners the significance of this particular ship and why you devote the time that you do to it in your book.
One reason I devote the time I do is because it and the mission that I referred to earlier that conveyed 20,800 British troops to eventually Singapore had the SS America, then renamed USS West Point, our number one passenger vessel that competed pre-war against much more famous ships from the French lines, even German lines, Italian lines. Everybody had their ship of state, and ours was the SS America. The SS America, as the USS West Point, then appropriated by the Navy, and having been built to be converted if necessary, it traveled all the seven seas. It went to every place that had the need for troops, and it took hundreds of thousands of troops and refugees on missions and on needs to land at faraway beaches to staging points. It survived the war completely intact. I sailed on that ship with my late wife on its final voyage, and it was one of those accidents that seemed to be part of my life as a writer. And I knew about its history, but I couldn't find anything on the ship on its final voyage to New York that would remind me of its epic history until the final day when we were entering harbor and we were all looking for Lady Liberty on the port side, on the left side of the ship. And my right hand gripped a handrail on the boat deck, and I looked down, and on the handrail from one end to the other were the initials, the carved hearts of all of the people, the refugees, the survivors who somehow made it through history's greatest war. And it almost brought me to my knees to know that that great ship had a great history to tell. In fact, in my office just now, I'm looking at the menu of the final night on the final voyage, which I keep here in the office as a reminder of the ship and its epic place in the history of World War II.
Hmm. You finish that chapter by saying, as the great statue, meaning, of course, the Statue of Liberty, came into view, the author's hand gripped a mahogany handrail on the boat deck. Preserved along the railing were the names, initials, dates, and penknife-carved hearts of those who had arrived before, the GIs and refugees, orphans and immigrants, silent witnesses all to valor, sacrifice, and salvation. Well, we have just scratched the surface in terms of what is offered up in your book, including really interesting discussion of factories that were part of the so-called arsenal of democracy, some factories now shuttered but still standing, and an also intriguing chapter called Remains of the Reich, intact traces and unexpected places in which one sees signs of the Third Reich that still remain in modern Germany. All of this and more explored in your fascinating book, The Hidden Places of World War II, The Extraordinary Sites Where History Was Made During the War That Saved Civilization, published by Lyons Press. Jerome M. O'Connor, thank you so much for joining me on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
Greg, I'm very happy to be with you and your listeners. Thank you so much.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program.